Roll call, please. Or, Yasmin, you want to do a roll call for us?
Hero?
Yes.
Beanstalk?
Here.
Bagai?
Present.
Christensen?
Thank you.
Blazik? Will be absent. Brady?
Here.
Brownstein? Brownstein? German? Lau?
Here.
Snell?
Here. I see German on, but I didn't hear him confirm. I don't know if he's on or not. But
agenda item 2. Review discussion and possible action on committee meeting minutes. I'll make a motion to approve the open session minutes from December 13th, 2022.
I'll second it. Lau.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries, none opposed. Agenda item 3, notice of proposed rulemaking. Jessica, are you on with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Great. Yeah. Thank you for being here.
Sure.
I'll turn it over to you.
Okay, so this is where we left off. I believe it was 1304. So we have a comment here about adding language about pediatric endorsement. And then we have a couple of questions about staffing requirements, comment.
Dr. Snell.
Thanks, Anthony. I had a question. Since we're starting into this 1304, are we going to we're starting into something that I think is Dr. Brownstein that sent in something related to this. Are we going to try to go through this line by line like we have in the past, or are we going to try to see if this is even doable with what we've been told about the dental board not having regulatory abilities over non-dental anesthesia providers, since that what this section is all about?
Ryan, do you want to talk to that at all?
To be honest, I prefer Seamus to jump in. Seamus, did you hear the question?
I thank you, Ryan. I did. this is AAG Seamus Monahan. I believe the question was around the board's authority to regulate medical providers who are not dentists who are providing sedation. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So that, and that's just a hard and fast rule. We only have jurisdiction over our licensees and certificate holders and business entities. We have no authority whatsoever to regulate any other practice, regardless of whether they're coming into a dental practice to perform that sedation.
But we would have the regulatory authority to certify dentists to work with non-licensed dentists. Is that correct? Like we currently do.
Yes, because your authority, again, is over the dentist. So Yes, you can allow the dentist to do certain things. Now, whether, you know, that other provider's board is going to allow them to do it, that's another question, right? And that's for that board.
Does that help, Heath?
Yes, it does. Thank you. So I would then we'll use them before and assume that the 1304 is going to continue with. I think there's been so much discussion about this. I just want to make sure that as a committee, everyone's okay with having a 1304 permit to allow those that don't have 1301, 2, or 3 permits to bring in a non-dentist provider, and that's what they will utilize a 1304 for. In previous committee meetings, we've talked a lot about obviously what this is going to look like and stuff, but before we get too far into it, I want to make sure that we have a consensus that this is what we want and how we want to move forward with it.
Dr. Brady?
It may be worth looking at Jeff's document and going through that as a starting reference, because I think that's going to clear up whether we go forward with the 1304 or not.
I agree with Dr. Brady.
Jessica, are you able to pull that up on your shared screen?
I'm sorry, can you repeat, pull up what portion?
There was a document circulated by Dr. Brownstein with the committee, or, you know, written by Dr. Brownstein, circulated via board staff to the committee. Do you have that?
Jessica, this was, I think, sent yesterday out, and I asked Yasmin to include you on that. If I can pull it up, I might be able to take over the screen.
I'll stop sharing for a minute.
Give me 1 second. So this was the document that would have been delivered, I think it was yesterday, maybe the day before, by Yasmin. Well, I guess it wouldn't have been the day before, that was Sunday, that Dr. Brownstein wrote up. Is there any place you wanted me to go in particular, Dr. Brady or Dr. Brownstein?
I think we should just open that up for discussion to go through it. You know, it seems like the direction that we have is that we're only able to not permit non-dental anesthesia providers. So it seems like relevant that this document may be the language that's adopted into the rules and regulations or what we may propose to have adopted.
Would you want to lead us through this, Dr. Brady? Dr. German, you got your hand up?
Can you hear me okay?
We can.
Oh, good. Hey, guys, sorry. Technical difficulties, I apologize. Thanks, Jason, for bringing this up. And I don't know if Jeff is on the line either. I read the document. I'm just curious what the real motive is here with this proposal. I understand the board cannot regulate non-dental providers, but non-dental providers have been providing anesthesia for a very long time in dental offices. So I'm just curious why all of a sudden the shift. It sounds like with this document, with this proposal, the non-dental anesthesia providers can provide anesthesia, but are limited to only the dental or anesthesia permit that the dental provider has themselves. So I'm just curious a little bit more about the agenda here, what the purpose is for doing this, the rationale that Jeff cites, sorry, I'm just scrolling through, is that he said something about the majority of adverse events had occurred with non-dental anesthesia providers, which is obviously not true. So I'm just curious a little bit more about the background.
Dr. Brady, are you able to answer that?
Not in its entirety. Jeff's not here. That's the unfortunate thing. So, you know, it's his document to defend, not mine. My only concern with this is when I'm reading this document, it does pose the question on how things have progressed from the dental board to have oversight in the dental office, just as like a hospital would have oversight what happens in the hospital. You have a non-permanent provider in office A and has an adverse event. There's nothing the dental board can do from that same anesthesia provider to go into office B and having a similar adverse event. And I think that's what Jeff is highlighting here. And that was one of my main questions. And hopefully either the 1304 permit answers all of those questions that I brought up from our last meeting, or we have some resolution on that matter.
Ryan?
Thank you. So this 1304 issue has surrounded my entire career at the dental board. Almost my first day I walked into a board meeting. I think I was 2 days away from a board meeting. I went to a board meeting and I was approached by a lobbyist and non-dentist anesthesia provider stating that they've been trying to get something resolved for the past 9 years or something to that effect. I said, okay, I'll look into it. And then what's now evolved started out in an infant stage, became this now committee that the previous board president started in 2019 with the first meeting in 2020. COVID derailed some of that conversation. And so this has been a long time coming. And I think that the biggest issue the entire time and the reason why this committee was created was to try to help, for lack of a better word, in the area of the 1304 permit and whether or not a 1304 permit should be required in a dental office if it's a non-dental provider providing the anesthesia/sedation. And I'm just giving a little bit of background. I'm probably going to defer the rest of my comment here in a bit to Dr. Caputo, who has a whole lot more history on this. Sorry to throw you on the spot, Dr. Caputo. But I've talked to him considerably about this almost since the time I walked into the office as well. Sherry Biggs has also been here. The 1304 permit didn't even used to exist until recent history. And I'm saying recent history in terms of the board has been around since 1935 and the 1304 permit came around like 2013 or something to that nature. And without saying more, because I think I've said enough recently to put my foot in my mouth, not in this topic, but an alternate topic, I would probably just defer the rest of my comments, because I think Dr. Caputo knows exactly what I'm leaning toward, but I would prefer him to say it in a much more professional and historical perspective than I can provide.
Thank you, Ryan. Dr. Caputo, you were put on the spot. Are you prepared to talk?
I feel bad. I should have taken a shower since it's a work at home day. But since you can't smell me, I guess it doesn't matter. And I'll still try to be professional. So the historical background on this is that back at least when I started my practice in 1997, the board had what was called a 1301 educationally qualified permit and a 1301 non-educationally qualified permit. The educationally qualified permit was obviously for those folks who could meet the criteria through education, which for the purposes of the 1301 was a dentist who completed either a oral maxillofacial surgery residency or an anesthesia residency. The 1301 non-educationally qualified permit was what we now look at as the 1304, which was for those dentists who wanted to provide sedation or anesthesia services in their offices but didn't have a permit, so they would get the 1301 non-educationally qualified permit. Effectively, what had happened was over time, the 1301 became a 1301 regardless of your educational qualification or not. And so that became very confusing to the board, particularly when a practice who had a very large footprint of dentists with 1301 non-educationally qualified permits working with multiple non-dentist anesthesia providers. And there was a concern about safety. There was concern about confusion of credentials and appropriateness of practice. So in trying to really figure out how to better identify the credentials or requirements for a dentist to have a 1301 non-educationally qualified permit, the board, when it was convened, or the anesthesia committee, when it was convened back in 2011-2012, came up with language to provide a pathway, and that was going to be through the 1304 permit. And so that permit was basically created at that time, and that separated it out from the 1301. I think what we've learned over time, and I really think to Dr. German's point regarding what's the purpose about the current language or proposal, well, I think like anything else, when we go into a process like this, what we know full well is you can't just look at one area of a particular set of rules and say that's what we're going to focus on. When you open up a rule, you open up the entire rule. And therefore, we're reviewing the entire rule here. And it merits to say that from time to time, it's worthwhile to go in and do the appropriate edits and changes as times change and evolve. And one of the things with regards to this specific area is that we learned that we, as we've already identified by through multiple people, we have no regulatory control, jurisdictional control over non-dentist providers who would administer sedation or anesthesia in a dental office setting. Understanding that, we also appreciate that there have been adverse events that have occurred, and through those adverse events, there was little or no opportunity to either immediately address the situation and possibly prevent another event from occurring, or put some system in place to protect the public. So while the language, as Dr. German identified, was not necessarily accurate regarding all, I think what's very clear is that we've never in the history of dentistry being practiced in Arizona, even with some practitioners who have had challenges with their sedation and anesthesia administration, we've never had two deaths occur within a very short span of time by the same provider. And knowing that the involvement of that provider to whatever level of responsibility, that's not necessarily our discussion at this point in time, they had, it still involved their presence. And the concern is, well, where's the safety for the patient? How can we do it better? How can we ensure that we are protecting our patients when they walk into a dental office setting, regardless of who's administering sedation or anesthesia for them? And I think that's kind of the background a little bit on where the current language that you're looking at from this document that's being presented comes from. And again, whether you disagree or agree with it, that's kind of, I think, where some of this is coming from based on the question that you had, Dr. German had asked earlier. I think what Ryan's getting at, which is sort of connected to this document as well, is what should we or shouldn't we do as a regulatory agency with respect to the administration of sedation and anesthesia in the dental office setting, if it's going to be performed or conducted by someone who's not a dentist. And understanding, and I think it has some merit, understanding we want to put a process in place for permitting of dentists who would administer sedation either at a moderate level or deep level or general anesthesia. We want those dentists to be appropriate and safe and have certain systems in place to ensure that. So then how do we do that for the dentist that might work with a non-dentist? And I think that's what is being addressed at this point in time. So hopefully that responds to some of what Ryan was getting at, but I think that's kind of where the foundation of this discussion is coming from. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Caputo, for the background. That's, I'm sure, it provides a good framework for us to work within today. Dr. German, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Caputo. I think we're all on the same page in terms of, I mean, the committee, from what I understood anyway, was formed to improve access to care and improve quality of care and safety for our patients and community. And that definitely should be the number one priority of this committee, is to protect the patients in this community. I guess I just have a few questions. This topic has come up several times throughout the course of the meetings of this committee. And I know it's been difficult to kind of come to a solution. I don't know that limiting the scope of practice of individuals who are licensed by their boards and recognized by the state to perform general anesthesia is the answer, given the need of access to care. So I guess my questions are, as a hospital can limit who practices in that hospital, can the board not limit who practices in their dental offices? So if an adverse event occurs, can the dental board not limit their dentist from allowing certain providers to provide anesthesia in their clinics after said accident, whether that's a dentist or a non-dentist? Just out of curiosity. And then secondly, I know that the specific boards do engage other boards, because we've worked with them before at different levels in the hospital, in terms of disciplinary actions. While that process is pending, why can the board not suspend someone's ability to practice their specialty within the dental offices that the board actually has jurisdiction over?
Seamus, are you on with us?
Yeah, I am.
Would you answer those two questions for Dr. German?
You know, I really can't answer it that much. You know, what I can tell you, especially in hypotheticals or a specific situation, but the basic framework is this. If they are licensed by this board, then we have responsibility over that doctor. If they bring somebody, a medical provider, in to provide that anesthesia, then they are required to somewhat oversee that, right, for the obvious signs that could come up and create an emergency. So your options in that regard with every board, and they're really not going to change, that's that you can refer the matter out, you know, say to the medical board if that's where the provider is from. And I get the question. It is a good question about, yes, the board does regulate business entities. So again, though, that is about the business entity and what kind of disciplinary action the board may take against them for bringing in providers who, say, aren't, you know, meeting the standards and doing their job appropriately. But I think now three of my predecessors have also said is that it simply is this, and I know it's a difficult thing to get your head around, but the hospital system is very different than the dental practice. And unfortunately, or fortunately, however you look at it, we simply just cannot regulate other providers. We either take action against our own or we don't, and we refer the matter out to that medical provider's board for them to handle the jurisdiction.
And just to follow up to that statement, thank you. Taking action against your own dentist who, for lack of a better term, employed that anesthetist, is not sufficient in preventing that anesthetist from providing anesthesia in that office again.
Well, that to me would be a business choice, right? That would be a choice by the business to make. And again, you could open yourself up to some kind of unprofessional conduct if that were to happen again.
Does that help answer your question, Dr. German?
It does. It just, we have spent months and months trying to figure out how we can allow these providers to provide the care that they were trained to provide and to help basically, you know, these dentists who need patients to receive anesthesia. I mean, I don't do office-based anesthesia, so I don't have any skin in this conversation when it comes to dollars. I know a lot of others in this committee do. But I'm on the hospital side, and I provide anesthesia for a lot of patients who dentists bring to the hospital. And I hear every single time I take care of these patients that they wish they had access to anesthesia in their offices, and they just don't. And there's not enough dentist anesthesiologists to go around. And frankly, a lot of patients don't have good insurance, or they're not cash payers. And I mean, I'll be honest, many dentist anesthesiologists refuse to take care of those patients. So they end up in the hospital, and it's a limiter to good access to care. And so I think this is, you know, an issue that we should address. I don't know how best to address. It's a can of worms that we're beginning to now open. But we have spoken for months about how to try to get these providers into these dental offices safely and have accountability for their track record, their ability to care for whatever patient demographic they're wanting to care for, and to do that through the dentist of that office that then reports to the dental board. And I thought we had had some sort of agreement on that, and it sounds like after Jeff's email, and now this discussion, that that's not now a possibility, which just baffles my mind, because this has been happening for a long time. So it just seems like our focus is now misaligned, and I think we need to be thinking about how can we allow these providers to provide care, but prevent the patient safety issues that have arisen. And maybe there isn't a solution to that. I don't know.
Thank you, Dr. German. Dr. Beanstalk, you had your hand up, then down.
Yes. So this document that Dr. Brownstein submitted to us, it's not saying that we may not bring in a non-dental anesthesia provider. It's saying if we choose to bring in a non-dental anesthesia provider, the dentist who does that has to have the same permit level that non-dental anesthesia provider has. So that way it does allow more safety for the patient, because we have two providers now with basically equivalent education level as far as the permit goes.
Well, I guess my question to that, Lisa, is why would that provider, that dentist, not just do their own anesthesia then?
Because not everybody is as comfortable and as a rock star like you are.
Well, my fear is it's just going to drive these non-dental anesthesia providers into other fields. You know, they're not going to be willing to. And I'm not trying to, maybe Allie, you can chime in, because you do this more in office-based setting. But my guess is it'll drive these professionals into other areas.
Allie, go ahead.
I'm all about patient safety. I think that's really important, as Dr. German and everyone else has been discussing. I think the problem with this that I see, and I think any other non-dentist anesthesia provider would see, is that you have a dentist who doesn't have training in anesthesia, who doesn't hold a permit. They can call a mobile permit holder, 1301, and have general anesthesia in their office without the operating dentist having any training whatsoever. what you're saying here is that that same dentist who doesn't have a permit or training in anesthesia can't have Dr. German, who's a fellowship trained pediatric anesthesiologist, come into his office and administer anesthesia. That's the problem. It's going to limit choice for dentists and who they can bring into their office. And we've talked about the two events with the same provider who now no longer practices in dental offices. We've reviewed all the cases of adverse events in this committee. Gosh, it feels like ages ago, but we went through all of that and looked at all those adverse events. All of the ones that we viewed happened to all be with dentists, anesthesia providers, either doing their sedation and the procedure simultaneously or with a dentist anesthesiologist. There were no non-dentist anesthesia providers in those cases that we reviewed. So that's the problem that I see here with this, is that it's going to limit access. It's going to limit choice for dentists for who they can bring into their office.
Dr. Beanstock.
Dr. Arnall was next, so I'll wait my turn.
Go ahead, Dr. Arnall.
Okay, thank you. Ali, I wanted to say the fundamental question here is, who can the board regulate, right? And we keep going back and forth, and no matter how we discuss it, it comes back to only the dentist is the only person that can be regulated by the board. Any dentist can call a dentist anesthesiologist to come in with a 1301 permit and provide anesthesia there, because the dentist that comes in with that 1301 permit can be regulated by the board. And the problem is, when the board is not allowed to regulate non-dental providers, the board must be able to have oversight over what happens in dental offices. They can only do that by regulating dentists. So reason tells us that if the board can only regulate a dentist and a procedure that requires a high level of oversight and regulation like anesthesia is happening in a dental office, it either needs to be provided by a dentist or overseen by a dentist, one of the two, so that the board is able to have some regulatory oversight. So either a dentist with a 1301 mobile permit comes in and provides it, or a dentist oversees a non-dental anesthesia provider providing it. The whole point of the document that Jeff sent in wasn't to say a non-dental anesthesia provider can't come in. It just strikes to the issue that if they do come in, the person who the board can have oversight over must have the educational background and qualification to be able to oversee that anesthesia. That's it. And it makes it very, very simple. If the board says either a dentist provides it or a dentist oversees it, then it takes care of that problem of regulatory black hole and lack of oversight.
And if a dentist is serious enough and does enough anesthesia in their office, they will go through the motions to get the permits that they need to bring that outside non-dental anesthesia provider into their office.
The problem I see with that, though, is there's only a couple pathways into obtaining a 1301 permit. So the dental board does have the ability to regulate dentists who are working with non-dental providers currently through this 1304 permit. If you do away with the 1304 permit and say the dentist can only work up to their level of permit, you're basically saying pediatric dentists, you're basically saying anybody outside of an oral surgeon and a dental anesthesiologist cannot work with a CRNA or a physician anesthesiologist in their office providing deeper levels of sedation. You've eliminated that possibility. And that is an access to care issue. So, you know, personally, what I would rather see, if we think the current 1304 permitting process doesn't educationally qualify dentists enough from working in these deeper levels, then maybe we tighten those requirements. But to eliminate the pathway for them to work with a non-dentist anesthesia provider, there are going to be patients that suffer to find care because of that. Dr. Snell, then Dr. Brady.
Thank you, Dr. Hero. I agree significantly with Ali. I do have a monetary stake in this game. And having said that, I still agree with him. I think there's got to be a way for the board to be able to regulate a dentist and say, hey, dentist, should you choose to have a non-dental anesthesia provider come into your office and provide a level of sedation, whether it be moderate sedation, deep sedation, general anesthesia, you have to know that you are going to be responsible for the outcome of that case. And there can be a standard set for what that office needs to have to allow that anesthesia to be provided there. And if there's a bad outcome, there can be, the board can decide what that looks like for that dentist. Even though they were not providing anesthesia, if we're worried about that, then they can set forth those parameters, and this is what's gonna happen as far as a consequence of having that non-dental anesthesia provider come into your office. I also caution a little bit. I know the recent events, the two events, let's keep in mind that it was one provider. As Ali pointed out, when we reviewed all those cases before, there were no non-dental anesthesia providers that had any issues. And I worry a little bit, and I see this often with regulations, you have one bad outcome, one sour apple, and we swing the pendulum so far the other way, when in reality that was just a single isolated event that is super tragic and very sad and very unfortunate. But I'm not sure it regulates swinging the pendulum all the way to the other side to completely say, nope, it's impossible for these non-dental anesthesia providers to come in except for with a oral surgeon or someone that has a 1301 permit.
And I apologize. This is Kelsey Lundy from Compass. Can I just get put on the list to come back to me when it's my turn?
Sure.
Yeah, thank this you. This is Christensen. I've heard that the adverse outcomes, there was no non-dental providers that were part of the adverse outcomes. There actually are. If you actually look at the list, there was two that I could count right now. It's pulled up on my desktop here. So I caution us. I've heard that twice already, and that's not accurate. And so I just want that on the record. There was actually some adverse outcomes involving with two non-dental providers in that case. So thank you.
Dr. Brady, you had your hand up at one point.
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. So just a couple of things, too. The vast... I would also say that the vast majority of dentist anesthesiologists takes Medicare and takes access. And so I don't think those are accurate statements to be placed. But getting out of that, I would say that if we want to build onto the 1304 and you're addressing my concerns have been the same from day one. And that's why I wanted the dental board to be able to issue permits to non-dentist anesthesia providers. That was the whole premise of what I was saying, because then everyone's playing the same rules. It's that simple. But we're not playing the same rules. And so it comes up with a lot of questions. I don't know if it's possible, but could you make a 1304 permit, like a registry to the board, of who every dentist is working with. So if there is, if you have to put a stop on a situation, the dental board is able to put a stop to the dentist that carried a 1304 that is utilizing a certain bad apple. That seems like a possible solution to me, so that they're not limited to only oral surgeons or dentist anesthesiologists for doing general anesthesia. But I don't know if that's even in the realm of what we're talking about, if that could even happen.
Ryan, do you have a comment on that, if that's something the board could implement?
So I think it's a great comment, and it certainly simplifies things. Seamus would probably have to weigh in a little more. I think the simplification of it is that the dentist is still responsible for the treatment, and the anesthesia provider, which is also licensed by another board, is responsible for the anesthesia administered. And so I think if the 1304 permit is just for the dentist to, for lack of total understanding, and maybe I'm getting too simple, I think is that the person holding the 1304 permit stating that I don't have education or training in anesthesia, and therefore I am going to employ a CRNA, a medical anesthesiologist, or a non-dental anesthesia provider in my office to do the anesthesia administration or sedation administration that I'm not capable of doing, but I'll still continue to do the treatment. Therefore, they're held accountable to the treatment of the dentistry, and the anesthesia provider is held accountable to the anesthesia administered. I think it's a great solution. It may be too simplistic. I don't know. Seamus may have a better comment to state.
Seamus, do you want to weigh in?
No, I agree with what Ryan said. I don't have anything to add to that or what I've already said previously.
Dr. Brady, were you finished? You still have your hand up?
Yeah, sorry about that.
Dr. Christensen, then Dr. Arnau.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Dr. Hero. I was just also wanted to comment on, I believe if a permit holder of a 1304 does not believe or understand that they will be responsible for anything that happens in their office as far as the anesthetic is concerned, then I don't think they've been fully informed. And we may need to readdress that with those that want to acquire a 1304 permit. I believe that having a dentist obtain a 1301 permit or 1302 permit and believing that they're going to be an adequate provider of anesthesia support in case of an adverse outcome, I don't know if that's really going to happen or they would even feel comfortable with that. And then I also believe that only allowing a competent a non-dental provider to come into an office and to limit them and what they feel would be best for that situation and that patient, I think that is fairly restrictive in many of these cases. And that's what I'd like to add to this discussion. Thank you.
Dr. Arnau, before I get to you, let me call on Kelsey Lundy.
Thank you so much. It's been quite some time since I think I've been before this subcommittee. I am with Compass Strategies, and we represent the Arizona Association of Nurse Anesthetists. I know that Allie has been an active participant on this committee. I just wanted to kind of make a few comments, which is obviously this conversation about the permit got restarted by our association because we were frustrated that CRNAs and physician anesthesiologists have a more difficult, challenging time in being able to access and provide anesthesia services in dental offices. And so we introduced legislation, and we were asked to pull that back so that this committee could come up with recommendations on their own Now, I understand that COVID hit, and so that was a little bit of a hiccup, but we've been now talking about this, I think, since late 2018, maybe early 2019, and we're not any closer to a solution. And so I know that this has been talked about, but I really am not understanding what the safety implications are. CRNAs and physician anesthesiologists can be treated just like any other dental anesthesia provider who is considered a mobile permit holder at the dental board. It's just that the CRNAs would have to have all of those, make sure that all of their requirements are checked off by the nursing board, and physician anesthesiologists would have to have theirs done by the medical examiner's board. And the dental board can still hold accountable dentists if for some reason an adverse action happens in those dental offices. But what I don't understand is that the statute's pretty clear that CRNAs are in fact allowed to practice in dental offices, just like they are in any other facility that has anesthesia. And so I think that I would re-put out there something similar to what we were pursuing back in 2018, which is that CRNAs and MDAs, because the last time I checked, if you're a mobile dental permit holder, those dental offices that they're providing anesthesia in, they don't necessarily have to be inspected by the dental board. So they're going into offices that have not been inspected to ensure that they have all of this necessary equipment that they're supposed to have. There's no difference in the quality of anesthesia provider between a dental anesthesiologist, a CRNA, or a physician anesthesiologist. And so if the dental board is comfortable with providing a dental anesthesiologist with a mobile permit because they have shown that they have the qualifications and the required equipment, I guess what I'm not understanding is why the same wouldn't be, why you couldn't have the nursing board adopt the exact same rules for a CRNA and the medical board adopt the exact same rules for physician anesthesiologists, that they are qualified and that they have the equipment that they can go, and then they can go into any dental office. So that's my comment. I will say that the association, you know, I understand that everyone has been, I think, in good faith trying to come up with solutions and ensuring that we're protecting patient safety. But we're really not any further than we were when the conversation started. And in fact, some of the comments that we hear actually potentially could make it more difficult for these anesthesia providers to be able to go into dental offices. So I really think the simplest approach is looking at that mobile permit and applying those same requirements and the same qualifications to ensure that all anesthesia providers can go into dental offices and provide anesthesia to patients. It's going to expand access greatly and make it much less of a challenge, and actually takes a big burden off the dental board for all of these inspections that quite frankly take too long. We can't wait 12 months for a dental office to get a 1304 permit so that a CRNA or a physician anesthesiologist can go in. That's not acceptable. That is not good patient access to good patient dental care. So that's my comment. Again, we're a little bit frustrated that this hasn't provided the resolution that we were hoping for when we pulled back our legislation in 2018. We're looking at all of our options at this point. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Arnell, I think you were next.
Okay, thank you very much. The question, you know, people keep talking about the question of access to care. People keep talking about the question of, you know, providers providing equal anesthesia, equal quality of anesthesia. That really isn't the question. The question is regulatory oversight from the dental board. And all those other things are peripheral issues to the central question of regulatory oversight. And for example, the people keep mentioning the cases that the board has reviewed. And Ali mentioned that there were few CRNAs on there. Well, of course there's few CRNAs on there. They're not required to report to the dental board. The only people that are required to report to the dental board are the dentists. And often dentists don't even know about that requirement. Now, my colleagues are keenly aware of it. As mobile anesthesia providers, we're all keenly aware that if there's an issue, we report it to the dental board. But your general dentist that has never been trained in anesthesia and really has very little interaction in the anesthesia world, the majority of them have no clue what the reporting requirements are. And I personally know about adverse events that happened in dental offices with non-dental anesthesia providers that were never reported. And I know the vast majority of my colleagues also know about those adverse events. They don't get reported because the CRNAs and physician anesthesiologists simply are not required to report them, and the general dentists have very little knowledge of the reporting requirements. The data, to use that data and say that it's heavily skewed dental, the data is corrupt, of course. It's full of dentists because they're the ones that are required to report. But, and again, the issue isn't attempting to limit people's ability to practice the trade that they're educated in. It's simply that the dental board must be able to regulate what happens in a dental office. They can regulate dentists, so the dentist must be, they must have responsibility for what's done.
Thank you, Dr. Arnell. Dr. Caputo.
Thank you, Dr. Hero. This is another thing just to sort of set the record straight, because this has been said a few times by different folks and it's just not accurate. And so I just want to make sure everybody understands clearly what our rules say. So as a mobile anesthesia or sedation provider, our rules specifically say two things that are being overlooked here by some folks that have commented thus far, and I just, again, want to make sure it's clear. The first thing is we have to report support by virtue of an affidavit that's submitted to the board that when we walk into an office to administer any level of sedation or anesthesia, that we are supervising a team. And minimally, we look at that team as three members. That's certainly what's required for deep sedation, general anesthesia. And so if we go into an office, regardless of where that office is, whether it's the first time we've been there or the 28th time we've been there, we have to ensure that the appropriate team is in place. We have to ensure that we appropriately discuss with the dentist and their staff as part of that team, that they understand what's happening, they know the services that we're providing, and that in the event that they're directed by us, they have to follow our direction, and we are supervisory to them in that instance that's required, and they understand their responsibility there. So this idea that we can just show up somewhere and we could just do what we do and not be responsible to anybody, it's just not an accurate thing to say. We actually have a very directed responsibility when we go to any office, and we have to support that. And part of the regulatory oversight that's been referenced is included there. So if we were to have an adverse event, or if we were to have some type of situation where we're being reviewed by the board, and if there was a deficiency anywhere with regards to the team, we would be responsible for that. So the idea that a dentist who could bring in a non-dentist anesthesia provider, it is a little bit oversimplification to say that the dentist just focuses on the dentistry and that person just focuses on the sedation or anesthesia, because it wouldn't actually be equivalent to what's currently required by our rules for any permitted dentist. We have a level of responsibility for the safety of the patient by virtue of a team approach. The second thing that's important, and this has got just kind of blown by with respect to talking about inspections, because it was just not right or correct, and I just want to make sure we have accuracy on this. When a dentist receives their permit, particularly as a mobile provider, they also provide by affidavit to the board that any location that they go to provide services, they will ensure there's duplication of the equipment and supplies that they were reviewed upon for that permit. So yes, we are reviewed and inspected at a location, but we are also verifying by affidavit that we will go into any other location and provide the same level of duplication of equipment and supplies. So we can't just walk into another office with a few things or just partial stuff or whatever. We have to ensure that any office that we go into has all the necessary equipment and supplies. And in fact, the prudent provider will contact an office in advance and say, yes, I'm happy to provide services for you, but these are the things that I need from you. I need to know that your staff has this level of training. I need to know that your operatories are of a certain size and appropriateness. I need to know that you have oxygen available in your office, or we will have oxygen available. So there is actually a fairly large requirement by that provider to ensure that it takes place when they go to another location. So I just don't think it's accurate to say that we can just go anywhere. It almost becomes somewhat flippant to make that comment, and I don't think that that's intended. And I just want to make sure everybody understands that there is a bar that we have to satisfy. And again, part of that regulatory oversight is that we meet that when we're providing our services. So I just want to make sure that's clear and part of the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Joseph Rodriguez, I think you had your hand up next.
Hi. Thanks, Dr. Harris. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
So I think I actually know some of the people on this call, but my name is Joe Rodriguez. I actually own a practice in Arizona and practice with dental anesthesia, and I'm actually on the board of our National Professional Association, which means I get to sit in on a lot of these types of phone calls for states across the country. Very difficult issue to solve, and really appreciate everybody trying to do so. I think right over the document that was submitted today, the primary challenge there is that the dental board, as has been said many times, can't regulate professions outside their purview, but they can't do it directly or indirectly. Right? And when I read through that language, I'm familiar with the state where it came from. It essentially does the same. It essentially regulates CRNAs and physicians through, not through direct authorization, but through indirect authorization. Right? By saying no to dentists, you have the same net effect. So I think that's the challenge there. And I think it kind of goes against the spirit of what the FTC has ruled on back in, I think, North Carolina a number of years ago now. The comments on apples have been well taken. I think it was Aaron Rodgers, Dr. Aaron Rodgers in this state, who had the pediatric issues a number of years ago now. And it was a really unfortunate series of events, but it doesn't take anyone real long to kind of find bad apples in any profession. There was a article just in the New York Times just this past week on a anesthesiologist. So that's not a good way to set policy. I think the fundamental problem here is not just who does the dental board regulate, right? The fundamental challenge is we have one specialty and three different professions. What has worked in other states is when you have, you know, every profession being regulated by their own board, which is what everybody, I think, agrees on here, we still need some sort of interdisciplinary approach. And what I've seen other states do and work well is every profession has their own authorization, similar to what they have here already, sans these problematic regulations from the dental board, which we're trying to fix now. But a interdisciplinary committee exists. Everyone's represented. Everyone has that psychological safety that's key. They make recommendations to the regulatory boards because they have that interdisciplinary specialty-based expertise. It works well. It solves the conundrum of regulation because no one's regulating anything they shouldn't. It solves the conundrum of making sure all the specialists are at the table, so to speak. So I offer that as something to consider, and also just to make sure we're not trying to do anything directly or indirectly through the language that's proposed. So leave it there. Thanks so much.
Dr. German.
Yeah, I'll just make a quick comment. Someone had mentioned something about dentists not being able or not being familiar with the reporting requirements for adverse events, but the 1304 permit actually is quite clear on what needs to be reported to the board. So a dentist who has that permit, who brings in a non-dental anesthesia provider, should be, per the permit, very aware of what adverse events need to be reported and how that gets reported. My second comment is this. Non-dental anesthesia providers are practicing anesthesia in dental offices all across the country. And it just seems like we're reinventing the wheel here and talking without a lot of data. I think it would behoove this committee to maybe table this topic, get some information from other dental boards across the country, and figure out how they have been able to work with non-dental anesthesia providers to provide safe care. I mean, in Jeff's document, it alludes one state and just a few comments about it and how they do it. But there are other states all around the country that are doing this, and they're doing it safely, and they're doing it professionally, and it's working out well. It'd behoove this committee, I think, to get that information and then maybe have this discussion another time.
Thank you, Dr. German. You went right where I was going to go. Ryan, is that a task that our board staff could take on? We just creating, you know, a spreadsheet of the different states and kind of a brief description of how the rules they've adopted regarding non-dentist anesthesia providers.
So there's been, let me just say yes. Obviously, especially if the committee charged the staff to do that, I'll just say a simple yes. I will say that there's been a ton of discussion recently about board and the anti-regulation or deregulation of the entire country in regulatory boards. I don't even like to call the dental board a regulatory board. I call it a health board. And a lot of the issues are surrounding like how long it takes to do X, Y, and Z, how long it takes. By the way, it doesn't take 12 months to issue a 1304 permit. I just wanted to state that, it's fairly quick. There may be some 12 month times that have come up, but not since I've been here. But in a root cause analysis, the biggest problem is that this board, in its entirety, not the board in the makeup of the board, but the staff has been understaffed, under-resourced, under-supported, and underfunded for God knows how long, probably since 1935. So can we do it? Yes. Is it going to take a lot of time? An extensive amount of time, because there are other states that do things, like Dr. German pointed out, great. We try to do this a lot, to look at other states, not to compare ourselves to other states, but to see what other states are doing and to see if they're doing it more effectively than we are. We just did a CE review of CE. We did renewal fees. We do a lot of this comparison and contrast simply because we want to know where we land within the rest of the U.S. jurisdiction. And I'm sorry to belabor the comment, but it's frustrating when I go across the street to the legislature, and the common thread is the boards aren't meeting the 180-day benchmark to get complaints done. Well, the root cause of that is we're under-supported and under-resourced, and we have been for an eternity. And until things change, it becomes a struggle. So I had to say that because a lot of what's happening across the street and with this board has been so frustrating, and people that have never sat in this chair are the ones that have the biggest opinion, but generally the most incorrect opinion as well. So sorry to pontificate on that, but yes, we can. There will be some boards that we will run into that likely won't be super easy, and it takes a lot of time because we would have to call and speak to somebody over the phone. There are some that aren't even autonomous boards, but they might be an umbrella board, which makes it even more fascinating to try to get information. But we can certainly start that process and bring back as much research on an ongoing basis, and hopefully we can complete it.
Thank you, Ryan. Ali?
I appreciate everybody's input on this. I've got a few thoughts. You know, one to the idea of reporting, physicians and CRNAs are required to report as well. I completely believe, Dr. Arnold, that there's probably been cases where things and adverse events were not reported. I'd also be very surprised if there are circumstances where dentists without non-dentists involved had adverse events and they let those slip through the cracks and didn't report them as well. You know, Joe spoke to bad apples. There's always going to be those people in any profession that don't follow the rules, despite how good the rules might be. So that's one piece. Dr. Caputo spoke about, you know, what they do for due diligence before going to an office and then making sure that everyone in the office is part of a team and everyone is invested in the care and safety of the patient. Physician anesthesiologists and CRNAs do that as well. Sure, there might be some bad apples. I'm sure there's some dentist anesthesiologists, bad apples as well, that aren't as diligent as, you know, Dr. Caputo and Dr. Arnold and I am. But that doesn't mean that an entire profession doesn't perform that due diligence. We have gone down so many different paths on how to solve this problem over the last 3.5 years. We thought we got really close a little over a year ago when the DA's office came in and said, you can't do it. So, and they told us at that time, this needs to go to legislation. So we did that, and then I got outcast from this committee for a little while as a result. It's kind of come to a point where it seems like that's where we have to go, because Dr. Arnold's completely right. How do we provide appropriate oversight in a dental office when we know that the dental board cannot regulate non-dentists? One way to go, and it's been brought up in this committee, was to do what medical offices do, where if they want to administer general anesthesia in a medical office, they have to have DHS come in and certify the office, and it falls under the jurisdiction of DHS. I think the board's been pretty clear that they don't want to do that. So if the boards are just regulating professionals and you have three different professionals that provide anesthesia services in dental offices and many other places, it really should fall onto the respective regulatory boards to regulate those dentists. And maybe that means beefing up rules on the medical board and the nursing board to ensure patient safety. In fact, I'm sure that's what it would take, because you need to maintain that patient safety. But I mean, guys, we've been at this for a really long time and we haven't gotten anywhere. And going and seeing what every other state does, we're going to get a mixed bag of all sorts of different things, I believe, that aren't really going to tell us what we should be doing in Arizona. So I wish that I had a fix. I feel like we've gotten to the point with this committee where we're probably not going to be able to fix it. And my recommendations is what to do now, is for the time being, just leave section 1304 as it is, because from what we were told from the DA's office, 3.5 years of us going back and round on this, really seems like legislation is going to be the only way that's going to fix our problem.
Dr. Brady.
Hey, thanks. I appreciated Joseph and Jermaine's comments. I just wanted to see, because I think it's an excellent idea to look at how that actually works with other states, with some kind of collaborative agreement and some kind of ad hoc committee that has the investigatory body looking into those things. My biggest concern is, you know, the dental board has to set up rules and regulations that they see fit for that community to be safe. Everyone's got different opinions on that. We've been dealing with this and going through the waves of this with this committee all the way throughout, but it's what we come to some kind of consensus on this at the very end. And so, you know, I wouldn't totally get rid of the 1304 permit, but if there's a way that it could work where it actually is in harmony with an investigative board that's board of their peers and also with all parties of interest that are involved with that, I think that's an excellent, probably, way of it sounds optimistic to me. I mean, I got to look at it a little bit more. I don't know anything more than what you testified with, but it would be good to kind of explore that option. I've never been on the bandwagon of, like, excluding anyone. Never have. I don't think any of us are, but I've always been that we should all be playing by the same rules, and it just seems like an impossible puzzle. But maybe this is something that can kind of reassure that. And it's unfortunate, and it is true, that there has been a recent event with non-dentist anesthesia providers where they've had an adverse in one office and then an adverse in another office, and we know about it. And it's whether the nursing board took appropriate action or not, I'm not commenting on that. It's just that I see that if this adverse event would have happened with a permanent dentist provider doing anesthesia, it could be stopped very, very soon, very abruptly. So if there's a way to get everyone on the same page with that, I'm all about that.
Dr. Arnout.
All right. Thank you very much. I've heard from Joseph and I've forgotten the name of the woman that spoke earlier. I just see her phone number. I apologize. We've heard from you that you feel that it's restriction of trade to put any kind of a limitation on some, you know, another anesthesia provider from coming into a dental office. But it's very simple if you just reverse it to see that is the absolute standard going the other way. Dentist anesthesiologists absolutely cannot just walk into a hospital or a medical office and provide general anesthesia there simply because the rules and regulations don't allow it, and because the processes for that are only allowed for nurses and physicians. So if we're going to be fair and apply those rules the other way, it's not restriction of trade to provide them this way. Second, access to care. The total volume of children seen for dental cases with access, the vast majority are done by dentist anesthesiologists in dental offices. The people who hold the credentials for access in dental offices are dentist anesthesiologists. Conversely, those that hold the credentials for seeing, providing anesthesia for access, children in the hospitals and surgery centers are CRNAs and physician anesthesiologists. So it is a little bit disingenuous to say that nobody is seeing the access kids in dental offices. That is easily 98% of my practice and that of every dentist anesthesiologist I know in the entire state. But very simple to see that if we look at the rules that are applied to us to walk into a hospital or a surgery center, it's very disingenuous to say that we're restricting others when we actually do allow CRNAs and physician anesthesiologists into dental offices. Thank you very much.
This is Attorney General Seamus Monahan. I just want to jump in. That way I can frame this for us so that we really understand what North Carolina v. Dental was about, because I think it's important to this conversation. It would be considered potentially an FTC issue, exactly the same as in North Carolina v. Dental. They attempted to say that that teeth whitening was the practice of dentistry. And if you're doing it, you're practicing without a license, or you need to have a license. So, you know, the argument here is the same. You're attempting to expand your regulatory authority to an area where the legislature has said you have no authority. And that does create an FTC issue. And so it's something that, you know, you should keep in mind when you are discussing this. And another point, hospitals are regulated by DHS. So the rules for a dental business entity and an entity that's regulated by DHS are vastly different. So I think that needs to be understood too. Thank you.
Seamus, are you talking specifically about the document Dr. Brownstein provided?
I'm not speaking specifically to it. I'm just saying in the state of Arizona, DHS regulates hospitals Whereas we regulate business entities that provide dental care, and those rules and regulations are vastly different.
No, I'm sorry. I meant going back to the North Carolina teeth whitening suit. Are you saying the existence of a 1304 permit follows that same potential issue, or limiting what CRNAs and physician anesthesiologists can do in a dental office falls into that issue?
Trying to limit what a CRNA or doctor could do.
So
you may be able to lobby the medical board, but I'm not sure that the nursing board or medical board would be in favor of limiting their own licensee's ability to do things. Again, the referral process and you initiating complaints against your own licensees is the correct way to handle the issue.
So, I guess we've spent a lot of time talking about this today. One question is if the committee is even on board with Dr. Brownstein's document. Because if not, then I think we're belaboring a point that we don't even need to talk about anymore. And let's go down the line, Sherry, just call on each committee member. I'll start. I am not in favor at all of limiting the ability of a CRNA or an MD anesthesiologist to go into an office and work to the permanent level of the dentist. I don't think that's a function of improving public safety. I do think it limits access to care. So Sherry, just let's run down and cut to the meat of this right now.
Beanstalk.
I think it's a start. Maybe not the equivalent permit level, but the permit below, because that way at least the dentist knows how to recognize and manage an emergency to add another layer of protection for the patient. And like I said earlier, if the dentist is serious about doing anesthesia in their office and bringing someone in, they will do the due diligence to get the permit that they need to allow that to occur in their office, and that brings another layer of safety.
Bagai?
I agree with Dr. Hero.
Brady?
I'm going to abstain because I just feel like we don't have enough information to go one way or the other. I mean, I don't think this is a fair question at this point.
Well, so all due respect, we've been talking about this for years, and this document was provided today. We've been talking about it for a couple hours. I feel like this committee had enough information to make some at least a statement. And Dr. Brady, I respect you abstaining, but I mean, let's get to the heart of this now. Keep going, Sherry.
Christensen?
I'm not in favor of the document at this time.
German?
I agree with Dr. Hero. Do not change the 1304 permit. We've discussed this for years. We seem to have all been in agreement in the past. I vote do not change.
Blout?
I vote do not change.
Snail?
Since the question was about the document, the way that document is written, I'm not in favor of the way it's written right now.
Thank you, Sherry. So I mean, that at least addresses the document. I don't disagree with Dr. Beanstalk's comment, but I think there's a way to get there through utilizing the existing 1304 rule or certificate and potentially maybe beefing up some of the educational requirements or the permitting process of it. I don't want to see pathways closed to good dentists that are trying to help a population that needs it. I see some more hands up. Dr. Lout, why don't we start with you and then Dr. Brady?
Yeah, I think that there is some relevance in that document. I kind of agree with Dr. Beanstalk on that, but I think that we really need to look at the other states as well in making the final decision on that. We've done the 13-4 this whole thing for a long time, but I'd kind of like to, you know, make sure that the dentists are equipped and they're, you know, in case there is an emergency that they can help out the nurse anesthetist or the dental anesthesiologist or anybody else. I just think that contributes to the safety of our citizens of Arizona.
I totally agree with that. Dr. Brady, you had your hand up at one point.
Yeah, I just think that, you know, Ali's worked really hard on this 1304 permit to address like some of these questions that I have. And so maybe there is something there. I hear what you're saying too. We need to move this forward. I get that. I'm not ready to make that commitment to say, you know, does that mean that 1304 doesn't change at all? Or is there something that can help our community feel that we're at ease with what that is, with all parties of interest? And so that's why I abstain, but I'm just echoing the same thing. But I do agree with what you're saying, Dr. Hero.
Yeah, and I agree with you as well, Dr. Brady, in the sense of, you know, I wasn't suggesting the 1304 permit doesn't need its language updated. Where I oppose and what I think was important to try to flush out right now is limiting or even indirectly regulating CRNAs and MDs from practicing to their own level of anesthesia by restricting them to the level of the dentist that they're working with. So I do think we need to go through the 1304 rules. I do think they need to be updated. I just don't think that that restriction is appropriate. And for the sake of the conversation today, I think it was important to flush that out. Ali.
A couple comments, and I apologize because it's actually a little bit off topic, but was touched on, and I don't have Dr. Arnold's number to call him after. But two things that you mentioned. One was regarding Access Dental. So Access gets divided into two groups, a medical and a dental group. So you are absolutely right that 100% of the payment from Access Dental for anesthesia done in dental offices is done to dentist anesthesiologists for very good reason. They won't pay anybody who isn't a dentist. So CRNAs and physician anesthesiologists can't bill Access Dental and dental offices because they won't pay us. So that's one I wanted to clarify. But then the other one is a piece regarding the fair playing field and DHS rules that don't allow dentist anesthesiologists in surgery centers and hospitals. That came up in this committee like 2 or 3 years ago, and I thought that was awful because I think that dentist anesthesiologists have expert training in anesthesia and should be able to do anesthesia in hospitals and surgery centers. I looked into it. I forget who I shared it with, but you literally have to change, like, just run a bill. No one's going to oppose you. You have to change one rule in DHS rules that defines what an anesthesiologist is. Currently, an anesthesiologist in DHS rules defined as a physician who has completed a residency in anesthesia. All you have to do is change that rule to say a physician or dentist who's completed a residency in anesthesia, and I don't think anybody's going to oppose you guys. So that's it. I think you guys, dentists, anesthesiologists, be able to practice wherever you want. So that's just a couple of things I want to respond to, a little separate from the 1304, but I just wanted to put that up there. Thanks.
So, let's talk about where we want to go from here. I'll start. I mean, it's a general comment, but I think next time maybe we start going line by line in the 1304. If the general consensus is we're going to keep the 1304, we just need to update the rules. But let's open it up for more discussion on where should we go. Dr. Caputo, I'll start with you because you have your hand up.
So this is going to put things on a little bit of a tilt. Well, I think you need to just get rid of the 1304. I think what you want to do, which I think addresses a lot of what's being raised right now, is make the 1304 more of a listing of requirements that the dentist must have satisfied when they are going to have sedation or anesthesia administered in their practice. So I think if you did something like that, it addresses, I think, the safety issue at some level. It can address training as well, because you can direct what sort of training you might want that dentist to have, such as ACLS or PALS, based on the patients that are being treated. but you're not speaking to any other type of provider, right? You're saying if you're going to work with a non-permitted Bodex dentist, this is what your office needs to have in place. And you're responsible for it. And we, and I think someone mentioned this earlier, we need to do a better job of, and maybe tightening up the rule this way, of ensuring that the dentist knows they have a level of responsibility when someone walks into their office. And as other folks have mentioned, they have a level of responsibility when a mobile provider walks into their office. It may be a little bit different, but they still have a level of responsibility. And I think we've kind of missed that in some of the ways we've created our rules. So I think instead of considering going line by line and maybe trying to change things here and there, I'd throw the whole thing out and start over and just look at it from the virtue of how would you create a safe practice? And something that Jason said several meetings ago, but it's resonated with me ever since, was, and we were talking about the administration of volatile agents, and we started down the discussion of an MH protocol. And he looked at it more globally, and he talked about the idea of, I'm not going to tell you how to administer anesthesia, and I'm not going to tell you what drugs to administer, but you should understand those drugs and you should understand those procedures. And as a result, you should have an action plan in place. And that really struck me. I said, yeah, you know what? That's what you need to have. You don't need to. And I think that's maybe the point here, even with this entire rule, is we're trying to almost to, in a sense, over-regulate on a lot of these things. And when we over-regulate, I'm going to switch to my investigative committee hat. We put a lot of burden on those folks who investigate these complaints, particularly the board, as Ryan has mentioned, is understaffed and under-resourced, to fully investigate and go through these complaints to determine what may or may not have happened based on what we have in front of us from a perspective of statutes and rules. And so maybe we need to step back a little bit and say, maybe we're being too restrictive in our approaches here, trying to make it safe, versus if we step back and said, we want safety, but we can get there a different way. And so I would propose to you creating a listing of what you think would be a safe practice and utilize that as your framework for what that 1304 permit might look like. Thank you.
Would you see as part of that being some type of database where the dentists are listing the actual provider demographic information that they're working with? I mean, like, we're working with Ollie Bagai, we're working with Joseph Rodriguez, you know, something like that.
Well, I know, because just like what happens to us, we may have a new person and we're not necessarily going to know who they are, or they might bring somebody new into their practice, and things change. I don't think we need to get caught up in that kind of thing. We just need to say, listen, you're going to have a person come into your office. That person is going to present themselves to you as a professional who's trained at this level to provide the service that they provide. And you have to be prepared for them, and this is how we want you to be prepared. And you have to understand that if there's an adverse event, you are going to be held to a level of responsibility, and this is what that's going to look like. And I think it gets us out of this trying to worry about what the nursing board does, what the medical board does, because you know what? The nursing board and the medical board don't care about what we do. They're worried about their own folks. And while I think Joe's comments are admirable with respect to a interdisciplinary committee, we already established with some of our recent events that the nursing board wasn't really interested in collaborating with us as a dental board. And I just don't think that we need to worry about that. Maybe we can address that down the road, but I think right now what we need to just say is, let's create a safe practice space for our patients, and we start by doing that by telling the dentist what they're responsible for and not worry about anything other than that. these folks come in and Ollie said it, you know, they have a level of due diligence that they follow. Perfect. That's what we all want from each other. And that's what we expect. Because honestly, if you think about it, that's exactly what the hospital does. The hospital doesn't look at whether you are going to administer dexmedetomidine over midazolam and at what dose, or whether you decide to intubate your patient or not. What the hospital wants to know is, do you have the credential to provide the services that you can provide? And then they say, if you have that and you and your department that you're going to be affiliated with is willing to sign off on your level of credential, then you're in. And you know what? If there's a problem down the road, the hospital is going to do what they do internally to address it. So I think that just, like I said, it tilts things a little bit, but I think it's a better way to approach this than trying to look at the level of training that we may, because we're not going to get there, folks. You're not going to get that. It's just not going to happen, unfortunately. And I think we can kind of alleviate some of this if you do it maybe this way. And obviously, I'm not the decision maker here. I'm just offering a proposal to maybe approach this a little bit differently and kind of think about it that way.
Yeah, no, so, we appreciate it. And I mean, it's well thought out. Ollie and then Dr. Snell.
You know, I really didn't come into this meeting today thinking that I would say this. I really like the direction that Dr. Caputo is going here. I think if I'm understanding it right, you're kind of saying the 1304 would essentially be a checklist for the dentist who knows when someone that is a non-dentist comes in, I got to make sure they've got X, Y, and Z to safely do their job and take care of our mutual patient. Make sure that they have the qualifications, right? I mean, that could all be outlined very similar to like what a hospital does with credentialing. I really like this. I like this direction. You know, there's one piece of it that you talked about where, you know, in that situation where the boards didn't really work too well together. You know, I wonder if there's something that could be done to, clarify inter-board communication on events where professionals from the respective boards are involved. Like at minimum, cross-reporting, right? If the dental board finds out about an adverse event, then the dental board is required to report to the nursing or the medical board for other professionals involved. Because I don't know if there's a I don't know if anyone else on the call can speak to that. I don't believe there is a requirement for the boards to do that between each other. But, I feel like this is the best direction that we've gone in discussing this in a long time. So thanks, Dr. Caputo.
Dr. Snell.
So I'm just curious, not with what is currently in our document with all the red lines and stuff. And maybe Dr. Caputo could speak to this historically, but isn't the 1304, when it was written, was pretty much just what you outlined in the fact that this is what the dentist, I mean, when you look at it, it says for them to apply, they need to have these things, name, all the hospitalizations, all that stuff. And then they need to make sure that there's emergency drugs, electrocardiograph monitor, pulse ox, cardiac rhythm, so on, so on, so on. It kind of outlines the things that we expect for them. In fact, in number four, what is it? So it'd be B4. It actually says that the 1304 provider provide confirmation of completing coursework within the last 2 years prior to submitting the permit application in one of the following: ACLS, PALS, or recognized continuing education course in advanced therapy management. So that's a list of things that's already in here of what these 1304 providers need. Is that's what you're saying, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, we could just create that list, and certainly not asking you to create a new one or enhance that. But I also think, and I think Seamus talked about this a little bit, Ryan talked about this a little bit, and some other folks touched on it too. We have to do a better job, and we being our collective profession, as well as through the board, of ensuring that we get the message to the dentist
that they have a level of responsibility here when this is done, because I think that's where it gets missed. I mean, I just want to take a look at the one case that happened where the CRNA worked in an office where the dentist didn't have a 1304. I think if that CRNA was doing their due diligence, they would have made sure that dentist had that. And if they knew they didn't have it, they would have said, I'm not going to do this case. The dentist would have hopefully been held to a level of response. So somewhere along the way, we should have had some accountability, even just starting there, right? And that's what I'm trying to get at is how do we create an environment where we're working hard to say, listen, we are going to do this at an appropriate level, because if we know that we don't, then we have a level of responsibility that we're accountable for. And that's kind of what I'm getting at. And maybe we just have to spell that out a little bit better. And sometimes that regulatory language gets jarbled up and it gets confusing. And I can tell you, I mean, I've read state board regulations for a lot of states. They're all different, man. I mean, I think it's amazing that they're so different. And they're hard sometimes to really figure out what's being said. And I think there's a way to do it more simply. And I think you get a better result at the end. But I'm not disagreeing with anything that you said, Heath, at all.
Dr. Brady.
Thank you. I was going to just kind of ask a question with Ali, because I think he's saying some of the same things that I am, too. And I know that he serves in a different capacity, being on the board with the CRNAs as well, and having some kind of collaborative thing with the nursing board. Right. I know you kind of had looked into that a little bit when we broke off on subcommittee. And also, did we ever review the application for like a dentist permitting a non-dental anesthesia permit for the Mississippi one, where it kind of helps the dentist kind of vet out those providers, whether they've lost hospital privileges or things of that nature. I'm not quite sure. I'm just wanting a reminder if we did that or if that was something that you had looked at. Maybe that's something I just can send to you to take a look at as well. Because if that's the direction that it goes, I think that might be a good thing for us to, as a committee, to look at.
Yeah, we went down that path looking at what they do in Mississippi for anesthesiologists and what they do in California, right? And that was kind of how we got to the, you know, if you look at what's in our agenda with 1304, it's a mess. If you guys recall before the last meeting, I circulated a message to the group saying, let's revert it back to this, because there's basically two different paths of ideas of where we're going to go that got mumbo jumboed in there. And that's when, you know, the AG office came in and told us, you know, you guys, they kind of stopped us. You know, I think there's one piece, like I said, I really like Dr. Caputo's idea here. I do think for patient safety, and it's outside the purview of this committee, I think we've kind of figured out, I like the idea of a 1304 being a checklist, but I also think there's another side to it other than the communication between respective boards. I think there probably needs to be some more formalized accountability from the medical board and the dental board, where they would maybe issue permits to CRNAs and physician anesthesiologists who are going to go to dental offices. Just to, you know, because if you put all the accountability on the dentist to, you know, go through their checklist, I think you also got to put some accountability on the CRNA or physician that they're going to comply. And it probably needs to go to the regulatory body that would be the ones disciplining them. So it may be that, and I think it would require legislation to make it work, because there's no formal direction and they would need that. But I think that's one other component of it for it to really work for patient safety, would be to have that piece to it. And like I said, it's outside of this committee, but I think it's something that, I mean, I would be willing to absolutely work on that to make sure it happens.
You know, one thing the board could consider, this is G. Seamus Monahan, I'm sorry, the committee could consider, would be a good place to start, would be a recommendation to the board that they adopt a policy that any adverse occurrence that's reported goes directly to the board of the individual who was involved, who the other provider who is not a dentist.
Yeah, that'd be great. Jessica. Jessica.
Hi, can you guys hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. So to Seamus's point, if the board wants to have some sort of policy, I would recommend putting that in rule, saying that the board sends that to the governing body of whoever is licensing that particular individual. Typically, you don't put stuff like that in rule because that's more of what the board's doing. So it would make sense that Seamus is mentioning policy, but that would put the public on notice that the boards kind of are communicating to each other with regard to complaints that involve the same situation.
Dr. Snell.
So I hate to do this because of what all the work that he has put into the 1304, but I agree with him. Anthony, and maybe this is a question for Jessica as well, but I really think Dr. Caputo's comments are valid, and it provides a way for non-dental. I mean, to me, it's what the 1304 has been from day one. And if we could go back to the original language, knowing that we tried to go down all these other venues and ways and we got halted along the way, if we could have Jessica just go back with, take out all the red line stuff, just go back to the way the 1304 is now, I think it really does move the work forward of what Dr. Caputo was suggesting and all he, kind of agrees with. And then let's just start there. Maybe there's some things that we can take out or whatnot, but I think it provides a good framework to start from. And it's a fresh start work of where we currently are without all this other stuff, because a lot of this other stuff is the way it's written now. When I read it, I'm like, oh my gosh, where are we going and headed? And it'd be nice to just go back to the original.
Well, maybe we should look at another subcommittee to review it and make recommendations to this committee at a future date. What do you guys think about that?
I agree.
Ryan or Seamus, couldn't we put Dr. Caputo on that subcommittee, even if he's not on the full committee?
So I'll defer to Seamus. I don't see why not, simply because this board has the ability to make up committees to help in its mission. So, but I think that the board should probably be the one that makes the committee as opposed to this committee. So the recommendation, and maybe that's what Jessica was saying also, is to have a recommendation to the board to make another subcommittee, which makes everybody super thrilled, but that just means this will continue a little bit longer.
Well, we've had kind of informal subcommittees branch off from this committee without board approval.
True. But the board picked members of this committee to be on this committee. So the subcommittees are, so I'll say subcommittees, it's usually two or three people together collaborating on something. But it has never included somebody not on this committee. Dr. Caputo is heavily involved. He sits on another committee, so I don't think that there would be an issue. We have to amend the board agenda anyway, as you know, Dr. Hero, for Friday's meeting. I think that it doesn't hurt to put it on there, but I would let Seamus weigh in and give a better, probably legal opinion.
AED Seamus. I agree with Ryan, especially with the meeting coming up on Friday. I think it's just easy to just create. I mean, you're going to be creating the subcommittee as the as the chair anyways. But yeah.
Okay. And does it matter if I'm creating that subcommittee in board, like at the, just logistically, am I creating it on Friday's board meeting or right now?
At the board meeting.
Okay.
But you can, if you guys collaborate now, the recommendation to the board could include members that this group is considering.
Absolutely.
So the whole, the whole recommendation would be not only to formulate this subcommittee, but also who the members should be.
Ollie, Dr. Brady, and Dr. Christensen, you guys interested in being on a subcommittee?
Sure, thank you.
Yep, absolutely.
And we're and Dr. Caputo.
Dr. Caputo.
And Dr. Yeah, Dr. Caputo. Dr. Christensen, are you okay with that?
Absolutely.
Great. So Friday, Ryan, we'll get that on the agenda and we can make that recommendation to the rest of the board.
Okay. Sounds good.
Great. Any other comments or discussion? Ali.
Yeah, I just want to share with this committee one thing because I don't want anybody to get surprised and flabbergasted. Deadline for submitting bills this legislative session is coming up. So we do have a bill that we want to put basically as a placeholder to be able to continue working through these things that may have requirements for statutory change. Like, for example, having the Board of Medicine and the Board of Nursing issue permits. So I just didn't want anybody to think there was something sneaky you're being done, just because there is kind of a deadline. And if we want to fix some of these problems and not have to wait a whole nother year, the hope is that this is something that members of this community and the anesthesia community at large could work together to get done on whatever pieces of it do require statutory change as opposed to just rulemaking change.
Great. Thank you, Ali. Is that you, Dr. Wall? I just
emailed you. Yeah, sorry. I don't know if you guys are taking recommendations, but if you guys are making a subcommittee, I think it would be great to have Matt Arnall on there as well. And the other thing is just as sort of a spectator, I'm just kind of blown away thinking that the 1304 would be done away with, because the 1304, in my mind, is nothing but safety. That's all it is. I mean, to get the 1301, we have to go through so much work to get that. You know, and to just do it away, I'm just like baffled. And that's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, I don't think we're talking about doing away with it. We're talking about scrapping the proposed changes and then starting from scratch with the existing. But anyway, we'll work that out at another meeting.
The 1304 permit is actually going to be strengthened, is where this committee, I think, is going with that.
Yes, Dr. Snow.
Thanks, Dr. Hero. I was just wondering, with other agenda items on here, are we going to talk about item number 4? I have some. That's not the rulemaking. I know that's where our focus has been, but I didn't know if we're going to move on to other stuff or if.
Yeah, why don't we move on right now? Because we can hit that and then wrap up.
Okay.
So I'll move us on to agenda item number 4, and Dr. Snell, go ahead.
So I don't know if everyone's familiar with that substantive policy that came out from the board, policy statement number 28. I don't have it exactly in front of me, but, and Dr. Hero or Dr. Christian, you can probably help me this, but it basically says it was from a 1302 provider who, due to, in his words, due to COVID and not being able to do the numbers of parenteral sedation cases, IV sedation cases, he went before the board to, you know, protest that we should allow for oral sedation that's done to a moderate level to count towards the requirement of number of cases to be able to renew. And so the question is here is, you know, as far as renewing, take possible action to recommend incorporating that with the proposed rulemaking. Based on what we have discussed in this committee, I think it's been well talked about that there's a large difference between parenteral and enteral sedation. I think if we're going to permit someone, especially that we have taken the 1303 to be enteral sedation to a moderate level, 1302 is parenteral sedation to a moderate level. If we want someone to have a 1302 permit and it needs to be distinguished between the two, then why are we not saying that they need to have a certain number of cases of parenteral sedation to keep their 1302? To me, it doesn't make a lot of sense to differentiate the two in the rules, but then say you can do enteral sedation and have it count towards your 10 cases per year for the parenteral sedation.
Anyone care to comment on that? I think if I remember right, this committee talked about this prior to this policy statement being drafted. Ryan, do you?
Yeah, I brought it up actually, Dr. Hero, because I was the one, the evaluator on that case, and the discussion was, you know, what do we do? And the resolution didn't come in that committee meeting, but then the individual, I think the case, what resolution did come is to that individual to go before the board, and the board would handle where he goes from there, because the re-eval wasn't approved because he didn't have the number of cases per what was in current rule.
So do you have you want to change how that reads?
I would prefer that it just go back to, if you have a 1302, then you need to have 10 cases of parenteral sedation. If you have 1303, then you need the number of cases for enteral sedation. I don't know why would we permit someone to have a 1302 and then say you don't need to do any parenteral cases. You can do all enteral cases and that's okay to continue with your 1302 permit in the re-evals. Why even differentiate between a 1302 and a 1303 permit at that point?
Can you bring up that language or screen share that? I'm just trying to find it. Sorry.
It's on page 43 in our packet. Ryan, maybe you can bring that up.
So you're saying doing, if they do all parenteral or enteral to qualify for, I mean, they can't do all oral sedation and then be permitted for IV. They might not even know how to start an IV, right?
Oh, that's not what it says in that policy.
Huh.
It says at the very bottom, you see that, it says all those 1301, 2, 3 under the administrative code should be determined by the depth of anesthesia and not by the route of administration. And we've been discussing back and forth that I thought that's where we were going with this committee, was that we were going to distinguish between a simply based on the depth, but then we settled in on a 1303 being an enteral and a 1302 being parenteral, which is then the route, and they can go to the same level. So to me, I don't know now if that's what we've settled on, how this policy could be, well, I can be do moderate sedation enterally for every patient I do, and still reapply for my 1302 permit.
So my initial thought when it came up was, well, how do you know the guy can start an IV, right? If they're doing, I mean, how you, I don't do oral sedation, so I would lean on those of you on the call that do. I mean, are people really doing oral sedation that gets somebody to a depth that you would do given Versed and fentanyl?
Dr. Brady?
Oh, you're on mute.
Sorry, can you guys hear me now? I changed to my laptop. So
yes.
Do you see what I put there in the chat? Maybe I'll save a little bit of this situation, right? Because we're talking about people doing oral sedation that don't start IVs routinely, they do an oral moderate sedation. So maybe the more appropriate thing is to have them adequately train on how to do intraosseous for emergency, for vascular access, and having the appropriate size of an intraosseous device, which is not that difficult with just a little bit of calibration for someone to learn how to do. My problem, I guess, with oral monitor sedation is, like, if they go into GA and they really need rescue drugs, they're not going to be able to find a vein. They're not going to be able to do vein and puncture if they're not practicing that often. So I think maybe adding some verbiage. Did you guys see that in the chat? And I don't know if that helps.
You can get Narcan and Romazicon IM.
If we could read just what's in the chat, because I don't think it'll be captured in the audio record for the meeting.
Okay, so basically.
I thought it said if it can't be Ranger's chapter. Yeah, he had it.
I can just read it. It's fine. It's basically just adding to the section F. We're not there on the screen share, but it's saying the section 1302 permit holder shall establish intraosseous access on each patient receiving parenteral sedation utilizing a new infusion set, including a new infusion line, a new bag of fluids. And then appending that is what I'm suggesting is, or shall have immediately available an age-appropriate intraosseous device designed for emergency vascular access and have been trained on its use within the last 5 years.
Dr. Lau?
No, I was just raising my hand because Ollie had asked about those who did oral sedation. Can they get to the depth of a 1302? And it can, but that's not the intention. And I don't see how you can really substitute that for intravenous sedation.
Yeah, I guess I was wondering more. I mean, I know you can get there. I guess I'm wondering how often are people, because that's what this is saying, that it should be determined by the depth of anesthesia, not the route of admission. So, I mean, someone's doing 10 oral sedation cases a year where they're getting to the depth of IV sedation. Maybe they're not doing it right.
Yeah, I think the moderate sedation parentally, the moderate sedation orally are two different things. They both meet the guidelines of moderate sedation, but you just don't let it get that deep when you're doing oral sedations. I don't think it should be a substitute. And I think that's kind of what he was doing, just kind of using that as a substitute for moderate sedation. I think that was his intent with doing this. That's my opinion.
Dr. Snow.
So, Jason, in your proposed language there, I don't know that I disagree with what's there, but I don't know that that helps this substantive policy. To me, this policy, and Dr. Hero, you and Dr. Christian can probably chime in more here because I wasn't at the meeting or how this came about. But to me, this, speaking specific to this policy statement number 28, it basically says that the board interprets 10 cases to show competency amongst those levels based on the depth of anesthesia. So to me, if I'm a 1302 evaluator, and I go in to evaluate someone's office for reevaluation to you know, get their, someone that already has their permit and they're just doing a re-eval. And I look up the records and they have 10 records of oral sedation and they tell me that was to a moderate level. Then as the examiner, I have to say, okay, that's, I'm evaluating for a 1302, but you're doing 1303. Sedations. Why am I going to, that doesn't make sense to me that I would permit you. I mean, even take it even to the more extreme. This is saying that a 1301 provider could say, I did deep sedation, general anesthesia with oral sedation 10 times. And so I can keep my 1301, permit without ever having to show that I've started IVs, that I've done any of that stuff over the course of the last 5 years since the last time I was evaluated. I think that that's getting into a real scary realm as far as how that's that language in there for to give someone a permit for a 1301 or 1302 when they're not even really doing that type of sedation that's outlined in our current rules with 1301 and 1302 permits.
Dr. Beanstalk?
So, Dr. Snell, are you recommending we get rid of the word not?
I would recommend we get rid of this substantive policy and just keep it as in the rules that says you need 10, if you're a 1301 provider, you need 10 cases of what a 1301 permit holder is outlined in the rules. If you're a 1302 provider, you need 10 cases as it's outlined in the rules of a 1302 permit, and same with the 1303.
I'm good with that.
Ryan, what's the process for us to retract this? Jessica?
So you would have, you would have to, I don't know, to be honest with you, because normally they just kind of get repealed on their own because they're outdated. But the board created the substantive policy, and you've heard my comments about substantive policies before. But since the board created it, I would surmise that the board can uncreate it. I think they created this because of the COVID issues and people were having a hard time getting cases in a couple of years. I don't think that's the case anymore. So you could probably go back. I mean, if you get rid of the substantive policy, the rule just takes effect, and it has nothing to do with the route of the, it has nothing to do with the depth or the route. It just goes back to what the rules state. If people have read this substantive policy statement and, or even printed it out and kept it, they may be trying to rely on it in the future, and which in that case, substantive policy statements aren't even legal documents that can be submitted to court anyway. So I don't think it matters either way.
So we could say that this committee recommends to the board to just retract this policy statement.
Yeah. Yeah. It would just be a repeal of this substantive policy statement. We would have to go through Secretary of State, I think, a little bit, and then, but we would just retract it off the board's website so people don't rely on it.
Jessica?
Yeah, that's pretty much accurate. You file something with the Secretary of State notifying them that you are essentially repealing the substantive policy statement, and that puts everyone on notice because I believe it goes in the register. The Secretary of State tracks all these, even though they're posted on the board's website. You do have to give notice to the Secretary of State to get it off of their books as well.
Ollie?
I just have a question. I'm surprised I don't know the answer to this after all this time, but what if the 1301, 2, or 3 permit holder doesn't personally administer the anesthetics and brings in a separate anesthesia provider and they do 10 cases with, say, Dr. Caputo? Does that qualify them to renew? Or they have to do their own anesthetic?
So that's a good question, Ollie. And I think to me, it was a little ambiguous because it was something I kind of wanted to get some clarification on with this committee, you know, a few years ago when we started it. But, so I think you posed a good question with that. Dr. Lout?
Yeah, I think we had addressed that a while back. We had a pretty hearty discussion about it, because of COVID and everything like that, as looking as an alternative to kind of observe somebody doing anesthesia, somebody that has a 1301 or 1302 or be involved in the case, as a way of getting, extra cases in case of, you know, things of hardship or things of that.
Yeah. And I remember we had that discussion. I don't know that we ever did anything with it though.
We didn't make a decision on it. No, we just brought it up as an alternative in cases like that. But it was strictly 1301 or 1302. It wasn't the 1303 to get credit for a 1302.
Right.
For IV sedation.
Because it also begs the question of, would it matter if I went in and did the cases where it's underneath that permit versus Dr. Caputo where it's under his mobile permit? You know what I mean? I don't know. Yeah. They're not really doing it. I don't know if it shows competency for it. You're saying they won't count it, Dr. Little? So you're shaking your head.
You're muted, Dr. Little.
I don't think it matters, but you guys have heard me already say that I think this is a silly requirement. Does your board ask you to do a certain number of cases per year?
No.
Thank you.
They do ask for continuing education. Actually, I take that back. Yeah, we do have to document. I was thinking of the state, but our national board certification, no, we do have
I'm
to
talking about the your licensing board. Do they require you to do a certain number of cases every year?
No. Nope.
And is
Dr. German is not on the meeting anymore.
All right. I'm pretty sure physicians, I mean, I think it's a silly requirement, so I don't care how you get there. But I would just say to you, Anthony, I mean, this is just at a board level, not necessarily for this, but to Ryan's point about substantive policy, if you're going to recommend rescinding this, I would ask you maybe even to have a committee look at the entire substantive policy statements and see which ones we can just get rid of, because they become really nonsensical for us. And as he said, we don't even consider these when we look at complaints, as you readily know. That's a side comment, but they're kind of silly too. So anyways, well, thank you.
I don't think it makes sense for dentists, anesthesiologists, or oral surgeons to do a ton, but maybe it makes sense for, you know, you don't think so either? Okay.
Ryan,
I like less regulations, so.
Ryan, what are your thoughts? I mean, I know you don't like substantive policy statements. Do you think we need to have them reviewed and, like a mass repeal?
Yeah.
Do we need a
committee? In short, no, I think that I can just probably print them out, give them to the board, and the board can review and discuss which ones they should get rid of. There's so many that are probably already super old or outdated, which is the same thing, excuse me. Irrelevant, I think, is the word I was looking for. So they're outdated or irrelevant, so there's three options. One, they just repeal the ones they don't think are relevant anymore. And then the second one is tell the board staff to either create a rule or statute to promulgate what the substantive policy is trying to do.
Okay.
So we can do, I'll make a note of that. Yasmin, in fact, will you just make a note of that? Maybe we'll put it on the March agenda and then the board can review.
Yep.
Let's just do that. Thank you.
Quit giving us more work, Dr. Trudeau. All right. Well, if there's nothing else, then I think we're going to jump ahead to adjournment.
Quick question, though, Dr. Caputo, or I'll talk to you next week, Dr. Caputo. Dr. Hero, do you want at least number 28 to be put on the January agenda to be reviewed?
Yeah, that's and fine. That was a COVID thing anyway, so we should get rid of that.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Dr. Caputo.
I thought at the last meeting you had assigned some homework to Dr. Snell and Dr. Lout regarding the requirements for training for the 1303, and I thought they were gonna report back. Was that supposed to happen, or did I just miss that?
Dr. Snell, Dr. Lout, you can
we had been assigned to do that. We reported on that last meeting.
Oh,
the assignment was given 2 meetings ago.
Oh, okay. All right. Never mind.
All right. We'll skip 5. Summary of current events. Any comments? 7. Shoot, you just took that down. Let's see here. Agenda item number 7, discussion and possible action items for future meeting agendas. Does anybody want to request any other topics to be put on? I mean, I think we got our hands full with this 1304 and the rest of the language. I'd rather not see this bad if we don't have to.
Dr. Hero, if I can, I just have a quick question. Do you want the staff to start trying to do a collection of states and what they're doing with anesthesia?
Dr. Brady, go ahead. Dr. Brady? Ryan, I'd put that on hold. Well, go ahead, Dr. Snow.
I was just going to chime in. He wasn't asking me, but I think just to make it put on the record, I don't think the board staff need, with everything that they have and all that's on their plate already, I don't think that's one thing that we should put on them to go after at this point.
Well, and I think that's something that can come out of a subcommittee meeting as well. I mean, we're forming a subcommittee, let them meet and talk through it, and then
you know, see what comes of it. Unless, Ryan, you just want to do that, like, on your Friday nights.
I'm thinking about getting my kids involved as soon as I hang up. But they're watching Prince Ali right now.
All right. Next committee meeting date is April 11th. And agenda item 9, adjournment. Thank you guys for your time. I know this has been long and involved, but we appreciate it. The board appreciates it. And we look forward to talking to everybody next time.